And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton on the FM dial at 93.3 FM, and also the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. This is our first program of the year, so we're pleased to bring in the new year with David Heap. We're going to be having him join us very shortly. Now, David, of course, is a member of the Canada Boat to Gaza Steering Committee, and he's been a delegate on the Tahrir. We've actually interviewed him in the past on this program about Gaza, about the Canadian boat and related issues, and we're glad that he can return with us. David, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Brendan.
Oh, it's great. I told our listeners last year, December and November, that we'd be speaking to our returning heroes from the Canadian boat to Gaza, and I know we had to wait a bit. You had quite a gauntlet to run through as soon as you got back to Canada. We'll talk about that. I guess we might need a bit of a refresher here, because both Ihab Lotayef and yourself were delegates on that boat when the Tahrir broke out. In fact, I heard about that breakout through email and Facebook. There was a bunch of early announcements. And so I thought to myself, who am I going to interview about this? There's breakout. So I think, okay, well, first I'll talk to Ihab, because, you know, Ihab, he's been on the program twice to talk about this. But, of course, turns out he was on the boat. So then I thought, well, David Heap, we were talking recently. I should talk with you. And, of course, you were both on the boat. So that scuppered my plans there. But, of course, Dylan Penner, fortunately, was in Canada. Yeah, he was doing a great job, as you know, organizing from this end. So we were able to speak with him, get the latest as soon as all the details came to us. And how did this switch happen? I mean, Dylan Penner, he was on the tour first.
Yeah, the last time I spoke to you was after our attempted voyage in June and July. And Dylan, of course, was with us then. We had a larger group of delegates in Greece where we were shut down and dragged back into port by the Greek Coast Guard. And Dylan was one of our media spokespeople on the boat, and he's with our steering committee. He wasn't able to travel with us this fall, so we had a little change of personnel. We had fewer people who were able to go for this departure, and we deliberately didn't announce it in advance because we were trying to leave without drawing attention to our departure, which turned out to be the right strategy. So we had, you know, people who had been in Canada before, like Ihab, were able to go in the fall. I was able to go again. Other people like Dylan assured part of our home team. And we had a fantastic home team of a steering committee from, you know, different parts of the country doing the media work, and Dylan from Independent Jewish Voices really stepping up and doing a lot of the talking to media on your show and elsewhere.
Yes, you had mentioned the special preparations there. I guess there was a certain degree of secrecy. Now, this was a breakout. You're waiting for the opportunity, I guess, but I don't know how long you knew beforehand that you were going to break out. I mean, did you, when you left Canada, know that you're going to be on the boat moving to Gaza?
Yeah, we had been in discussion with some of the other national initiatives about not being so predictable as to wait for the next spring or summer, right? Because the last two flotillas were made June, July, and we sort of thought that was getting a little bit predictable. And I mean, there's different things we learned from the experience in June and July in Greece. We learned that Greece is not a good place to leave from right now, despite the historical position of the Greek people. Their government is not in a position to stand up to international bullies right now, and so as a consequence, they're accepting the extension of the Gaza blockade into Greek ports. So we got the Tahrir out of the Greek port and into southern Turkey, and we knew that we wanted to do something, you know, when the timing was right, when there was at least one other initiative that could sail with us. And the way we were thinking of it is that because the big flotillas draw a lot of attention, a lot of media attention, they make it. They also put. Draw a lot of pressure onto the government, the state, whatever, of the country that you try to depart from. So the change was try a different country, but also try a quieter departure with fewer boats, not a big flotilla, so there wouldn't be so much time for Israel to prepare a campaign to put pressure on a country to stop us from going. So as it turns out, that was a strategy that works. We were able to sail with the Irish boat, the Sirsha, and we were both able to leave a port in Turkey. After a few administrative hang-ups, they kept us waiting a day. We weren't sure if we were going to be stopped again in port. It didn't look very good for a little while. But in the end, we were able to leave with a reduced number of delegates. So a disappointment was that we had to leave behind a lot of people who were prepared to go. We actually had about 36 people prepared to go between media and delegates. The Turks put what we thought was an arbitrary limit on that and said you can only take 12. So we had to do a last-minute cut of our delegation, which was no fun. But because the Irish boat was going, it was definitely the right time to go as a wave, as what we're calling freedom waves towards Gaza. So the idea being that, you know, rather than one big flotilla, which is easy to plan for and stop, we'll just have continuous waves whenever people are ready to go and challenge the blockade.
Well, that's quite a lot to take in. I guess there are these considerations about passports and customs and how mm-hmm. a country would let certain activists leave. So you have to go through those procedures. Now, you did have to limit the number of people on the Canadian boat, as you said. And I understand that the boat was not just Canadian representatives. Of course, there was an Australian, a U.S. journalist, and so forth. So you had to be very strategic in who you put on the boat. Now, the Irish boat, I guess perhaps you were both sailing together because that's when you were allowed to leave by the authorities. I'm not sure. How much planning was there in advance to work with the Irish boat or the Irish crew?
Oh, we'd been talking with the Irish boat for a month or two prior to this departure. They were ready to go. They had a slightly different composition. Their delegation was all Irish, but they had more prominent national figures. They had an ex-national rugby team player, member of European Parliament, a number of municipal politicians, so some fairly well-known artists, so a fairly well-known group of delegates, but they didn't have any media, whereas we had the capability, the Tahrir is a larger boat, we had the capability of having a satellite internet hookup, so we were able to have TV crews on. We had, some of your listeners may have heard Democracy Now! Broadcasting with Jihan Hafiz. We had Al Jazeera English and Al Jazeera Arabic. We had Press TV from the UK and a press journalist from Cairo, Lina Atallah, who writes for Al Masri Al Youm. So we actually had, you know, five journalists as well as six delegates from different countries. So we had a diverse group, and it takes some fine-tuning to get the right group, and then we had this sudden reduction from 36 to 12, which was, as I say, no fun to have to cut it down. But we were the main thing is we were able to get out of port. We were able to leave legitimately without being stopped by the Turkish forces. And then once we were in international waters, make a sharp left turn towards Gaza.
Yes, I saw one of those videos you mentioned with Ihab, and it was actually Ihab, and he was giving a live satellite or some kind of interview at night on the ocean. You couldn't see anything except his face. You couldn't even see the rest of the boat. I don't know if that was intentional. I know you had to be very careful with the information that you
were... No, that was just dark. We didn't have floodlights on that part, so we wanted to do something. I did a video with... I was pointing to the dot, which was the Saoirse, the Irish boat, which was in the background at that point. But we had other... Like I say, the film crews, the TV crews were able to get some daylight footage. So it was actually quite a bit of television broadcast via satellite link for the 2 days. So we departed on the 2nd of November from Fethiye in southern Turkey, and we sailed for about 2 days towards Gaza, so most of the way to Gaza.
Yeah, you excited and surprised a lot of people. We were following as soon as we saw the information, but that's where it gets confusing because the boat was intercepted and there was the boarding, and then we started to hear that one of the activists might have been tased, and then it was perhaps you that had been tasered, and we weren't able to get clarification on that for a while. Can you tell us what it is that happened there?
Well, the first thing you have to know is that the first sign, so on the Friday morning, the 4th of November, we were still broadcasting. They still put out some short clips on the TV. We still were able to take satellite calls and send emails. We got a last photo out of the six delegates, which is my lasting memory, is the six of us under the Palestinian flag in the bow of the Tahrir, which, you know, we were at that point less than 100 nautical miles. We were between 50 and 100 nautical miles. So that was as close as in the end we were getting. But once we entered that zone on Friday morning, this is what Israel has unilaterally and illegally declared to be their military exclusion zone, and a concept which has no basis in international law. International law gives states, you know, a 20 or a 12 nautical mile or a 20 nautical mile, or in some cases a 24 nautical mile security zone. Nobody has a 100 mile nautical mile security zone. It's simply a fiction in legal, in international law. Once we entered that area, we knew that our communications would be subject to blocking. And the first thing that always happens is the satellite phones go, the internet connection goes, we're no longer able to talk to the outside world. And what you have to realize is that if Israel had every confidence that what they were doing is legitimate, they wouldn't cut communications. I mean, when we were brought back by the Greek Coast Guard in June and July, we broadcast the whole time. We were on the phone the whole time. The Greeks, you know, they may not have liked what they were doing, but they didn't have anything to hide. Israel always blocks communications. They block the media before they move in. So we were cut off from the outside world, which is why you didn't hear, and we remain cut off from the outside world for actually into the second day of our imprisonment. So it was in early afternoon, after our communications had got down, that we were first hailed by the Israeli Navy, and, you know, they demand to know what your course is and things like that. But we'd known for a couple of hours, because our communications were going down, you know, the direction that that the events were turning in.
Yes, no, very difficult. I know you must have also been worried, considering what happened to the previous, some of the previous vessels, and including the Turkish vessel. So it was a situation of great danger. Once this occurred and you were boarded, there's a lot of hearsay, or just us relying on guesswork, or waiting for information. We know that you were detained. You were put in a prison, and we didn't know how long you could be in there. We had heard estimates that you might be in there for 2 months.
Yep. Well, I mean, there's two pieces of the Israeli information control strategy. One is to stop everybody else's signals, right? Block communications. They prevent us from talking, even though, you know, you have a right to speak to a lawyer if you're choosing. You have a right to speak to consular officials. All of that was denied for the first 48 hours. So they had, you and everybody else had no way of getting any independent information from us. And they begin their spin. They begin their story. No, nobody was harmed. No, there was no violence. So they control the story for the first day or two, and they begin floating all kinds of misinformation to confuse the situation. So we finally got calls out. It was 2 days later on Sunday. I got a letter out via one of our lawyers on the Saturday, and that was published in Canada and around the world, which simply described the fact that we had been captured. A couple of us were assaulted during the capture. I was attacked with a taser in the wheelhouse because I refused to leave our captain. I was ordered by a, you know, these armed commandos come on the ship. They're pointing weapons at you. They're slipping all over the place because they've wet the decks with water cannon. So it's not a very safe situation. And they tell me to back off. And I just say, no, I'm not gonna leave my friend here, the captain. And they said, you know, back off or we'll electrocute you, actually, is what he said. And then he used the taser on my arm. And then later, you know, so then we're searched, and then later they take our ship. They admit that they find no weapons, nothing harmful, no munitions, no armaments of any kind. But they're still stealing the ship and taking it to Ashdod, right, to the port of the Israeli port, which was not our course. Our course was clearly identified. They knew that we weren't going to Israeli waters. We were going from international waters to Palestinian waters off Gaza. At no time was our course through Israeli waters. But at that point, you know, the guys in the uniforms with the guns take control of the ship.
Yes. No, it's a familiar story. This is something that it's almost deja vu when we look at cases like this.
Yeah.
But you had made it that far. And then, of course, you were imprisoned along with the members of the Irish boat. And I guess that's where it becomes especially salient for us, because I think it's been suggested that the experience of the Irish activist was valuable, because they perhaps brought a helpful mindset to your situation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the Irish have a history of resistance to colonialism, and one of them had been on the previous wave, not on the Mavi, but in the flotilla, one of the smaller boats that was with the Mavi, so he'd been in prison. And they knew there were a dozen Irish men in the men's block with four of us from the Canadian boat. And the first morning, they had immediately formed a political prisoners committee because, you know, they're among them, they had that experience. A few of them had been imprisoned in Ireland, well, under the UK rule in Ireland. So they knew that the important thing was to stand together and to make sure that we were dealt with collectively as political prisoners and not individually as, you know, criminals or illegal migrants or anything like that. So it was actually very impressive because we, you know, we joined with them. So there were 16 men on our block and, you know, formulated collective demands that we wanted to be treated as political prisoners and, you know, not as common criminals. And that actually was a very important lesson to me, because for all of my life, you know, I've worked on solidarity causes, but this was a very concrete, real sense that solidarity worked, even, you know, even in prison conditions.
I agree, and I think standing up for yourselves like that perhaps is why you were released earlier than you thought you would be. Certainly we were happy to see you come back on that plane. We were surprised. It had been announced, but we didn't know how long you would have been there. Yeah. I mean, you must have been tired.
People around at the last minute. I mean, they're playing the whole time. They're playing mind games. They're saying it might be 2 weeks. It might be 2 months. Oh, no, we'll buy a ticket and you go home. Oh, if you sign this, you can go home. I mean, Ehab signed one of their documents the first night, and they said, oh, you can, if you sign this, you can go home in 24 hours. He was there the same 6 days I was, even though he signed their document twice. And you know, they said, oh, you have to sign this. We'll make you pay for your flight. We didn't pay for our flights. I didn't sign anything. So they're manipulating information. They're trying to play with your mind the whole time. The only solution to that, I mean, apart from whatever inner strength the individual brings, is human solidarity. And the fact that we were with, you know, a dozen Irish comrades who had this resistance mindset made a difference. And, of course, the strength in numbers. It makes a difference to be 16 people and not just a few.
Well, you did a good job when you got back, because I could have sworn I saw you guys on some national media.
Yep.
How did the media treat you when you returned?
Well, of course, I mean, we were on CBC Power and Politics, and of course they have their talking points. They sound like Israeli Hasbara, right? Like they're talking points directly from the Israeli embassy when they're asking questions. And of course, we didn't even know what the spin had been. We literally went from the airport to fly to get to the studio, so we didn't even know the lies that they'd been saying about us. So we spoke from the heart and about the experience. And, of course, all the journalists want to know, after this experience, if you'll go again. And the answer from both Ehab and me is in a heartbeat. Of course, you can't – I mean, the lesson to take away from this is that you can't let the bullies get away with intimidation. They thought after the violence they used in the Mavi that there wouldn't be another flotilla, and people came back. There was one or two Irish people in the earlier flotilla. They came back with a boat full. There were a few Canadians. We came back with a Canadian boat. So intimidation isn't having the effect of scaring people away from standing with the real heroes in this. The real heroes in this, of course, are the Palestinians of Gaza who continue to risk the to resist the blockade.
Yeah, that's...
And we just stand with them, and we, you know, we accept part of the danger for a short time because we stand with them, but they're the real heroes of this story.
It's two things that struck me from what you're saying there, and the first is you really did have to have a lot of courage, not knowing all the facts that were going around or what was being suggested or said about you and the flotilla. You had gone right from point A to point B, from ship to jail to Canada, and it's hard to know what's going on, but you were there giving statements and giving your account as best you could from the heart. And that's difficult because you don't have all the information. So that takes courage. And secondly, with the Palestinians, I mean, that's the ultimate goal of this flotilla was to draw attention to the blockade and explain how shipping mm-hmm. should be freely allowed and given passage onto the shore and offshore, imports and exports. Now, the aid was not physically delivered, and that was one goal of that project, but you also drew a lot of attention. Were you able to hear from Palestinians as well as to the effects of the flotilla?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the important things here is that we, from the outset and through the whole process and continuing now, we remain in contact with our civil society partners in Gaza. So, you know, student federations, teachers federations, trade unionists, agriculturalists, women's organizations, all of these people reiterated their call in the fall to challenge the blockade. They wanted international solidarity to continue this, and we're in touch with them now. And they know. I had an email from a colleague of mine who teaches French at Al-Aqsa University. You know, within a few minutes of when our communications went down, and he said, you know, even if you don't reach us, your message has reached us.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And in the end, the media impact, I think what you did, what the Canadian activists did and the international activists did, was force the world to confront the issue of the blockade, of the siege of Gaza. Just as when Israel bombed Lebanon in 2006 and then they bombed Gaza during Operation Cast Lead, that put the mm-hmm. conflicts and the problems into the spotlight. CNN and all the other networks had to cover it, and people had to ask themselves questions about what was happening and what was right and what was wrong. And now the flotillas have done the same thing, and that has drawn attention to issues which some people would rather just not talk about. And so it's come out mm-hmm. again, and it's now to the point where I read an article in Veterans Today, and it was called The Media Consensus on Israel is Collapsing. And, yeah. You know, this is something that it's getting around, articles like that one. It's difficult now for Israeli diplomats, new Hasbara outlets to promulgate certain views just because the world has been exposed to too much of what they like to call the facts on the ground.
Exactly. So the answer to repression and intimidation is human solidarity. We have to keep going. Not everybody, I mean, the nature of the campaign is not everybody can be on a small boat in the Eastern Mediterranean, but lots of people can be on board with the campaign. And that boat belongs not to, you know, a little steering committee or a holding company called Turtle Island Humanitarian Aid. It belongs to thousands of Canadians across the country and hundreds of organizations that got together on their campuses, in their union halls, in their houses of worship and community meetings and raise the money to buy the ship, which is already an amazing thing, and to send us. And that it's really solidarity from Canadian civil society to Palestinian civil society that's going to change this, because clearly our politicians have checked out, right? They're ignoring it. They're following the Israeli line. They don't want any attention drawn to this. So everything we can do, whether we're there or here, to maintain contact, to tell the people of the Palestinians of Gaza that they're not forgotten, and that our leaders may have abdicated their responsibility, but the peoples of the world haven't. That's what's going to end this blockade ultimately.
And it's becoming more and more part of a general discourse. Now, I know we have to wrap up, but I do know that you have planned tours or are constructing
That's
a tour.
True.
There are people that want to hear from activists in various cities. I don't know how far you've gone into this setup, but do you have a plan for the upcoming months?
Yeah, Ehab and I, over the next couple of months, will be telling our story in different places. I'm here in Ontario. I'll probably go to East Coast. Ehab's going to go west to the prairies and the West Coast, just to tell people. People want to hear the story that I've been telling about the experience, but our message is that the campaign continues. You know, here you have a boat that belongs to all these Canadians that's been stolen by a foreign state. They say they want to deliver the aid and keep the boat. Through their channels, they want to deliver the aid. Our view is very clear that the boat and the aid are a package that was intended for the people of Gaza, so we want it all to go to the people of Gaza. And that's the message we'll be taking to people, that a Canadian boat was stolen on the high seas. Our government is complicit with this and is acting like a branch of Israeli Hezbollah, basically. So people have to demand of our elected officials to take a position on this, our elected officials of all stripes at all levels, to take a position and say, whatever you think about Israel, whether you believe in 0-1, 2 or 3 states or whatever else, it's wrong for a boat that belongs to Canadian civil society to be stolen by a foreign power. That boat has been shown to have nothing dangerous, no munitions, no weapons at all on it. It should simply be given to the people it was intended for.
Well, a lot of people across Canada paid money to support that boat, so we do want to continue to get our money's worth on that. And if there is a tour stop in Hamilton, people will be hearing about it on this program, of course. So good luck with that. We're going to talk at McMaster, see what's happening. There will be a number of Gaza Solidarity-related events in the year 2012 here at McMaster and in Hamilton, so you can be confident about that.
And let's remember, we're in the last days of the third-year commemoration of the Castlet assault. So I know there'll be things happening on the campus where I work where people remember those terrible days, which are, the culmination of a very long crime of a blockade against Gaza.
Well, we can be very thankful for the good work you and the committees are doing. So thanks so much, David.
Thank you for your support.
Oh, great. Well, we'll have this on the Internet, and we'll get this to Tahrir.ca and all interested people. So thanks very much, David.
Thanks so much, Brendan. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Stay human.
Thanks. He said stay human before I could. I actually was going to say that. He has a lot of correspondence and encourages us and reminds us to stay human. And, of course, that is David Heap with the Canadian Boat to Gaza Steering Committee. He was a delegate on the Tahrir when it broke out and headed towards Gaza.